This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get an update from Black Lives Matter. The group still has concerns about police relations.
They don't feel confident making those complaints because everything is overseen by the police department itself.
Cinnamon Porter talks with GLT's Judy Valente about a continued Black Lives Matter push for a citizen review panel. You'll also hear from two ISU leaders. Charlie Schlenker talks with President Dietz about the budget and more. John Norton reports with the Illinois State University Athletic Director about outsourcing comprehensive multimedia rights. And as Wonder Woman hits the big screen, find out what makes her an enduring character. That plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 11th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A recent report by the Stevenson Center at Illinois State University underscored disparities in how minorities are treated in the criminal justice system. The local Black Lives Matter chapter is seeking to establish a civilian police review board to let citizens monitor and weigh in on police actions. Citizen review boards exist in more than 200 cities. A U.S. Justice Department task force on 21st century policing recommends them. Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner has opposed the idea. GLT's Judy Valente spoke with three members of Black Lives Matter, including Olivia Butts, who says tension between police and minority residents has been growing for some time.
The problem isn't new, but it does seem to go unnoticed. And so BLM has come together to kind of share some stories of the Black community with different city officials, with the police, and try to share those stories. And one of the options that we have proposed, along with some other allies, is a community review board.
Now, you're here with Cinnamon Porter, who is also a Black Lives Matter member. Cinnamon, what is your reason for wanting this citizen review board?
The main concern is that citizens, they have issues that they have with the police department, but they don't feel confident making those complaints because everything is overseen by the police department itself. So making sure that the citizens feel confident addressing issues that they have with the police department.
Why do you think they're not confident, Olivia?
You know, anytime that you have a confrontation with a group of people who have a lot of power or have a lot of presence in your neighborhood or in your area, it's going to be a little nerve-wracking to come and tell them that they're doing a bad job or that you didn't like the way that they're doing their job. And so right now what we have is really the police are policing themselves, right? And so I don't think that makes anyone comfortable when you're trying to think about how am I going to get justice for something that happened to me when I have to go to the group that maybe the incident happened with, right? So that makes it really difficult for people to come forward with complaints or issues that they've been having.
How do you envision this police review board run by citizens working?
I can answer that. So we've been working with some other community organizations who support a community review board. And a few things that we, Black Lives Matter, believe should be in this review board would be, one, taking complaints. Again, feeling confident that if something went wrong, they can bring it to a third party to make those complaints.
As opposed to having now make the complaint to the police department, go to the police department or make it online to the police department, correct?
Absolutely. So they have to make it to the police department as well as have the complaint notarized. So it's a very difficult process as well.
That might be intimidating for some people to have it notarized.
Sure. Absolutely.
You're also here with Louis Goslin, who is another representative of Black Lives Matter. Louis, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, so as Olivia described, the current complaint process basically requires you to submit a complaint to the police department, and people are skeptical, to say the least, that the police are going to police themselves. One of the options that have been presented in a civilian review board is that there is at least a third party that has an opportunity to give those complaints a second look, to where it isn't just, oh, the police say that there's nothing wrong, fine. A review board gives an opportunity for a body to actually look over it again. But in the end, the police do have the opportunity to investigate. However, this is just a second look. It's a chance for people to say, I don't feel that what the police determined in my case was right. I would like a second look. And then the civilian review board would have an opportunity to say, hey, we actually disagree with this finding, and submit it back to the department to consider looking at it again.
Who would comprise the board?
I think that's something that needs to be discussed between the city council and the mayor, along with different groups in the community.
The police chief of Bloomington, Brendan Hefner, has said he's opposed to the idea of a citizen police review board. How do you expect to get the idea off the ground when you don't have the support of the police chief? Cinnamon?
The community organizations in Bloomington are support. There are a couple of that are very supportive of this civilian review board. We have met with council members who are also supportive of this, as well as the mayor of Bloomington, who is supportive of the civilian review board as well. So there's a lot of support. Chief Hefner has also been to a conference that has one of the proposed solutions for community policing has been a civilian review board. So it's something that he's aware of. It is a nationwide solution to community policing.
Olivia or Lewis, I'm just curious as to how widespread the support is, say, on the Bloomington Council. Is it one person, two people, three people? Lewis?
Yeah, so before the election, we met with a number of Bloomington City Council members, and as of right now, I believe if we include the mayor, we're looking at seven people who sit at the council who support this, and we're excited at the opportunity for this thing to go public and for the council members to stand by their support with the upcoming committee of the whole meeting, rather, coming up on the 15th. And you asked the question about what do we do with the with this situation or with this proposal when the chief may not be fully behind it yet. I think that there is a need for some clarification with the chief. I think sometimes people are worried about losing maybe power or having somebody come in and meddle with the work that they do every day. And, you know, no question there are a lot of things in law enforcement that I'm sure require some level of leadership that requires that kind of power to be maybe protected or feel that it needs to be protected. One thing that needs to be clear, though, is when we talk about a civilian review board, we're talking about an opportunity for the community to have an institutionally recognized power to weigh in on what's going on with the way that their community's policed. It doesn't mean that the council loses power. It doesn't mean that the chief loses power. It means that finally the community has a chance to actually be heard, that the data that's already been released and that demonstrates a problem has a chance to be acted on. And in the end, the proposals are going before the council and the chief to consider and to enact. In the end, should the review board have some say in the complaint process, it's going to be up to the chief to determine what happens with their input.
I take it is the city council, for example, of Bloomington, that would have to approve this, would have to pass a law to approve this.
Yeah, we're asking for an ordinance to be passed for this to be created. However, this was one of the proposals that we put before Chief Hefner on December 15th during our public meeting. It's also something that we've discussed with him since then, and it's something that he should be familiar with because, as Cinnamon mentioned, Chief Hefner participated in the 21st Century Policing initiative that was put on by the U.S. Department of Justice. And in fact, in September, he attended a meeting at the White House to discuss this. Civilian review boards are a recommendation. In fact, it's their second pillar in their final report that was given by that task force. And so it's something that he knows, and it's a conversation that he's been a part of. And so it's our hope that through some conversation, such as what's going on with the committee, the whole meeting, he'll come to understand that this is actually good for building public trust. This is good for creating a relationship with law enforcement in the community that we would hope would be his desire as well.
Olivia or Cinnamon, you referenced that some people have had difficult times or less than satisfactory experiences in filing complaints. Can you give some specific examples?
Again, when you have to file a police complaint, you put down all of your personal information. There has been examples of folks being harassed by the police. There have been examples of folks having the police sit outside of their house and watch their house. And again, that's harassment, and that makes people feel real uncomfortable. So why would you go back to the police to file another complaint?
Well, let me stop you right there. Are these incidents that happen once in a while, or is this a complaint that you hear on a widespread basis?
It's rare that people even file complaints through the Bloomington Police Department because of the level of distrust. People don't have confidence that their complaint's going to be heard. When we go out in the community, we hear a lot of people who step up and say, something happened to me that I wasn't satisfied with, or I felt I was treated in an unprofessional manner. But when we talk about the number of complaints that actually come in through the police department, we're talking about less than 20 in a year. Now, some have said, well, that must mean that people are satisfied. Maybe the police aren't doing such a bad job. And we're not trying to necessarily make the case that everything the police are doing is bad, but we do know that the number of people who feel mistreated do not add up to the number of complaints coming in, and we don't think that that's because anything other than distrust, lack of confidence.
Well, I'm just curious, how many people have complained to you and said, I don't feel comfortable placing a complaint, I don't think I'll be heard? How many people, really?
So when we're out in the community and we're inviting people to, for example, come to a event at the Bloomington Police Department, or to speak up and tell their story at a public event like we had at December 15th. Many times people are coming to us and saying, well, there's no way that I'm going to speak out. Like, I don't want that kind of attention. I don't want to be, targeted. And so, there have also been a number of incidents that have been shared publicly. For example, the story that Josh Lewis shared at our December 15th event, and people said, well, why didn't his parents complain?
We're talking about... that example was...
We're talking about a 13-year-old kid who was the passenger in getting a ride, and the driver was pulled over, didn't have his driver's license, but the exchange between the person and the officer was cut short by the officer then directing his attention towards his 13-year-old kid and asking him a series of questions, essentially interrogating him on the side of the road while the driver of the car was just there.
Was the driver black or white?
Driver was white. White driver, black passenger, 13-year-old kid. And then when the driver asked, what was that about? We've had some instances of cars being stolen in this neighborhood. We just wanted to check this out. So here you have a driver who just presented registration and a kid who's a passenger who is now suspect for stealing a car. How that makes sense, I don't know. But the pushback in the community was, well, why didn't the mother complain? Why didn't someone complain? Well, we've asked that because nothing would come of it.
Olivia, I'm wondering if you see any movement on the part of Chief Hefner toward agreeing to a citizen review board. Has there been any change in his position from flat no at that community meeting in December?
As of right now, I don't think Hefner is super interested in a community review board, but I do know that he has a lot of stakeholders who are interested in a community review board. These are nationwide. We've seen these over 200 across the country. And so there's not just one way to do this, right? We're willing to work together and we're willing to work with him and make sure that he feels secure in how this would all work. But I think he would be open to the opportunity, but we're still kind of waiting for that.
Black Lives Matter members Olivia Butts, Cinnamon Porter, and Louis Gosland speaking about efforts to establish a citizen police review board. They spoke with GLT's Judy Valente. Black Lives Matter says it's seeking input on the proposal from community groups, including Not in Our Town, the YWCA, and local chapters of the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP. The group has asked for the topic to be on the agenda at the next Bloomington City Council meeting. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers, online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, a report on the increasingly desperate financial conditions in Illinois. And as Wonder Woman hits the big screen, hear what makes her a standout DC comic character. All of that still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University heads into another graduation weekend with no state budget, no state payments, and no certainty from Governor Bruce Rauner and lawmakers. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, President Larry Dietz takes the pulse of the financial health of the institution and says it is not yet a thready pulse and continues thumping along.
Well, it's it feels like the old movie Groundhog Day, and that is, that's been the same old for quite a while. But our enrollment has been strong the last several years. People have heard me say that before, and we're strong and steady. We may be down just a little bit this fall. Our numbers are coming in a little less than what they had been, but we've had three record years, and so that's expected a little bit with the demography and direct from high school students being reduced in the state. You add that to the budget impasse, and there's a negative vibe out there, I would say. But it's having a small impact, but we've been strong and steady. We've got those three record years in the pipeline now. Our retention and graduation rates are very strong, and so that helps us with enrollment overall. And our fundraising is coming along very, very well. Overall, we're doing pretty doggone well.
How much is enrollment going to be down in the fall?
Deposit rate right now would reflect that we're down about 3%, but that's less than 200 students. And so we have a plan in place to try to increase the number of international students on the campus to help meet our diversity goals. We're probably a year away from making any major impact in that area, but that's kind of our alternative plan for this.
That's a plan that many institutions of higher education have gone to, but right now is not a good time to be starting on that plan because the political climate internationally is causing places like the U of I, which has a lot of international students, to worry that those folks are going to go to Canada or Europe instead because of the immigration concerns and the visa concerns. How are you going to counter that trend?
Well, I would disagree that it's not a good time to start. One might say that we should have started earlier, and I would probably agree with that. But the bottom line is that the demand for an education in the United States, and particularly a demand for Illinois State University, is going to be very strong because our brand is strong. We've always been welcoming. We have not been as aggressive, in my estimation, about adding the number of international students. And we stand at about 2-3% of our total population coming from other countries. We've been open for a long period of time, and the fact is that we've got room to grow in that area because most institutions of our size will have 10-15% of their population. But our growth is not going to be at the expense of Illinois students at all. We still have about 92% of our students coming from the state of Illinois, and we're going to continue to be open to those individuals. But we plan to add some other individuals from other countries to that mix, and I think that will make us a stronger institution.
Are there certain countries that you'll be targeting, ones with relationships that you already have with institutions in those countries, South Korea, for instance?
Right. Well, there are. We're working with what's called a pathway group right now that is based in London to help us with some of that recruiting. The ones that have the most students who are most interested in the United States are obviously China and India. But we want our international population to be as diverse as our domestic population. So we just don't want students from two countries making up the difference in that 2-5% and then 10% and on from there. So we're going to be looking at lots of different countries. We have plan to bolster our English as a second language program. That's already a good program. And so we'll be working with the pathway program to identify the countries, the discipline, the academic criteria, and the numbers. And so we're going to do this in the same planful way that Illinois State University has been noted for.
Are there certain strengths that ISU has that will be appealing to international students? The U of I, of course, focuses on hard sciences. ISU's traditional strength has been education, but certainly there are other programs, biology.
Sure.
CAST,
sure.
Is the College of Applied Science and Technology, is another one. What are ISU's assets?
Yeah, well, we're strong in the physical sciences as well as in the social sciences. There are some disciplines that international students have traditionally been more interested in. interested in, and many are interested in business. We obviously have a very strong College of Business, and so some will probably enter that area. You mentioned the College of Applied Sciences and Technology. We have a new cybersecurity program that we'll be putting in place this fall. I think they'll probably be interested in that. Or Information Systems Technology program, I'm sure we'll have interest in that area. But we also have interest in the fine arts. My wife and I, when we have events at the house, we ask to have someone play the piano for entertainment for us. And most of the folks that come out are in the College of Fine Arts in the performance area and piano. And probably over half of them are from other countries. And then within the College of Arts and Sciences, another popular area is typically in the biology and microbiology, but also in other areas in terms of some students want to come in and study languages and literature. We have a number of students from China have a very strong interest in English language and literature. And so I think it's really going to be a broad-based appeal, and I think we'll do just fine.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU President Larry Dietz. A recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education is with tech futurist Andrew McAfee, who lays out some possible implications for higher ed from the coming wave of roboticization. We've seen that, of course, in manufacturing for years, but his contention is it's going to creep downward into traditional cognitive roles that are routine, things like payroll clerks and so forth. How is ISU preparing for that eventuality?
I found the article to be fascinating, and I would agree with the author in some areas in that robots oftentimes can do tasks that are repetitive, and there probably will be some entry into some of these other positions with robots. But I think the strength that Illinois State University has in regard to that is that we have a core curriculum that is really about education and not about training. That core curriculum involves our humanities and our social sciences that helps teach people to work in groups, to have critical thinking, to have problem solving, to be able to communicate in written and oral forms. And what we find is that those courses and that core curriculum lend themselves to individuals who are going to be going well beyond the training piece and the education piece and help figure out what are the issues of the future that need to be addressed and how they should be addressed and what are the futuristic problems that need to be solved. So I think we're positioned very well.
What else does this article suggest ISU should consider in the future?
You know, one of his tenets about reviewing our course offerings and making sure that we are really about the business of educating students and not training, but at the same token, also a realization that there are times that a traditional degree, maybe not what the individual wants, or that might serve the individual well. So I think we need to be open to online courses and perhaps expanding those while we've been a traditional institution. And we're really a kind of a high-tech and high-touch kind of an institution. I think our course offerings through the online process will probably extend a little bit. And perhaps we need to look at some other kinds of ways to help individuals learn through badging and credentialing or some new terms. Some of the old terms that have been used for a long time are continuing education units, CEUs. Those have been around for a long time. I think the lesson for us is that we need to be current. We need to be open to change and be able to respond.
ISU President Larry Dietz speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. ISU graduates 3,700 students this weekend. Trustees tomorrow take up a resolution for no tuition increase for incoming students this fall. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University Athletics recently outsourced its comprehensive multimedia rights to Learfield Sports Incorporated. The Plano, Texas-based company will pay ISU $19.8 million over 10 years for the rights to manage, market, and sell Redbird Athletic signage, digital, radio play-by-play, and coaches' shows. GLT's John Norton spoke with ISU Athletic Director Larry Lyons about the partnership, which breaks down to a cash and trade agreement that escalates in payments over the 10-year contract. Lyons says in year one, Learfield will pay ISU $1.2 million in cash and in-kind gifts totaling $375,000.
we have a certain level of in-kind already in our existing contracts with our sponsors.
Okay.
They're going to guarantee that same level of in-kind to us moving forward. And then if they can grow that, that would be a benefit, obviously, to us, much like if they can grow the cash side, which they certainly intend to do, because that's how they're also going to be profitable in this organization or in this contract, is to grow the cash side of the business, too. So it's a combination of both of them.
Let's get to the cash. It starts at, what, $1.2 million in year one. It'll escalate after that.
Yes.
So you're essentially breaking even on year one of what you probably would have done.
No, actually, in cash, we're just under $1 million.
Okay. So it's an extra maybe $300,000?
Yeah.
Okay.
Approximately. A little bit less.
So on average, over 10 years, it'll be about $2 million per year. Not necessarily in cash, but you know, the idea.
Right.
If Learfield would sell more than $2 million per year, is there any...
There's another level in the contract that if Learfield is successful at reaching what we'll call a ceiling... And above that ceiling, there are sales. We will split that. Now, that's not going to happen the first couple of years.
Right.
Their goal is to drive the business so that they get to that.
Just using rough numbers, they're contributing $2 million a year to ISU over the course of 10 years. If they get past $2 million, that's where it kicks in?
Correct. Now, it's again, every year is different because of the stair step of the contract.
Sure. If I have this right, you're either the 7th or 8th Missouri Valley Conference team to take advantage of this cooperation, I guess, or partnership. Why so long?
For years, we've sold our sponsorships, our multimedia rights, if you will, ourselves, and did it okay. And then about 5-6 years ago, we hired a young man by the name of Andrew Bond, who came from IMG, which is a Learfield competitor. So he brought that mentality, that game plan, that processing of multimedia rights to us. And we grew it from, we'll say, $500,000 in cash to just under $1 million in cash was where we're at right now.
Over the course of what, 8 years, did you say?
5 to 6 years
okay.
or so.
All
7
right.
years, something like
That's
that.
That's a nice percentage increase.
It's a nice percentage increase. You know, it was slow over the time. It, you know, it took some time for it to build up, get the systems where he needed them to be so that we were seeing the benefit of that. So our thinking was, you know, we're doing really well on our own. Is there enough value in the Illinois State brand for somebody like an IMG or a Learfield to come in and purchase those rights and guarantee us a number that was made sense for them and for us? It's not that we were not interested. We just wondered. So we had conversations with, there's different firms out there. We had independent conversations with them just in general terms about Illinois State and how we're doing, that sort of thing. So late last summer, early fall, we said, okay, let's test the water. So we put a RFP, request for proposal, on the street and gave them all the information. We have approximately 95 sponsor contracts. Here's the values in terms of in-kind. Here's the values in terms of cash, whatnot. What do you think? A couple of them didn't respond. One responded lower. That doesn't do us any good. And then Learfield came in with what we thought was a pretty good number.
What made you finally pull the trigger?
I think it got to the point where, and that's in discussions we've had with Andrew and our external folks, we think we've taken this as far as we can.
Okay.
Because our market is the local market. It's the Bloomington, Normal, Central Illinois market. We had no access to major advertising companies. Obviously, State Farm and Country are in our town, so we had access to them. But had they not been in Bloomington, Normal, we probably may not have had access to them. What Learfield can bring to the table is the economy of scale of all their business. They have 125 plus schools and other schools in Illinois. Add Illinois State to their portfolio, there's value to those national market folks. That's where we see some immediate growth. But then there's things that they're doing on other campuses that possibly we're not doing that they can take advantage of. So, and I think the one thing that helped us was being patient. Had we done this 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, the values we were producing were lower, so the contract for us might have been lower. Now that we've produced higher values locally on our own, also the brand name of Illinois State has gotten stronger over the last several years.
We're talking with Illinois State University Athletics Director Larry Lyons. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. How does Learfield help you on a national basis? Or is it more of a regional, like Chicago, St. Louis, things like that?
Well, there's going to be some of that. But on a national basis, let's say it's a major car manufacturer. We'll say Toyota.
Okay, all right.
They have contracts with Toyota nationally. Okay, now we're going to bring Illinois State into the mix. And what the Illinois State brand can do for and will that help increase the Toyota coverage? And does Toyota want to come in and be a part of an Illinois State program? I just use that as an example. I have no idea if Toyota has a contract. But we will also, at the same time, we will have the relationship with Learfield. They're going to have three people embedded in our athletic department. So that, they, in essence, they are with us every day of the week, even though their job is to work for Learfield and sell Illinois State through Redbird Sports Properties. We will make sure that the relationships we have with our local current sponsors are solid, make sure the transition goes well. And Learfield's going to come and say, let's try something. And we'll say, great, let's try it. Or they'll come to us and say, well, how about this? And we'll say, maybe we don't want to do that because of the impact it has on a current sponsor. So we'll be able to have those kind of dialogues with them moving forward.
I was going to ask you about that. What do you lose on the local level, especially by not having that direct person talking? It's a different company talking to, say, local advertisers.
Well, that'll be part of the transition. And we're, those conversations are starting right now. We're Andrew Bond or one of our athletic department folks is going to go with Learfield on a lot of these calls, the introductory calls. There's a transition taking place. Answer those initial questions. Like, there's a lot of questions about what is Learfield? Multimedia rights is not something that people have talked about at Illinois State for literally ever, other than, you know, we've kind of talked about it.
Yeah.
So we'll help in that transition, and we'll help develop those relationships, and we'll be a big part of all those relationships. They're still going to the sponsor that does a T-shirt toss is still having a relationship with Illinois State. They're just working through Learfield as opposed to directly with us. And so there will be those dynamics that will still be in place.
So someone like Andrew would be the liaison for something like that? The follow-up to that is what happens to Andrew now?
Okay, Andrew's going to be the liaison immediately just because that was his core business when he was working for us. He is actually going to transition into a fundraising role with us. It's going to help his career.
In athletics?
In athletics.
Okay.
Which is the win-win for us, because obviously we have the Learfield side, which is a guaranteed contract for us. And then Andrew is going to go, hopefully, and we expect him to have real success on the fundraising side. And there will hopefully be some new revenues there.
Okay.
So that's where the win-win comes in.
Does naming rights at all factor into this, whether it's for Redbird Arena, Hancock Stadium?
Naming rights are excluded from a regular multimedia rights deal. Now, if they bring somebody to us, then we have to have a separate discussion about that. But we can go out and try and do something like that.
Okay. WJBC has been broadcasting basketball and football since forever. Theoretically, that could be up for grabs. Is that only in theory? It's pretty much going to stay that way?
Well, their contract, coincidentally, we had a 5-year deal with them that ended March 31st. The Learfield folks are beginning to have discussions with JBC about extending a contract because the dynamics have changed. Learfield now owns the rights to broadcast the games, to sell the advertising, to do the coaches' shows, that sort of thing. So Learfield will now work with JBC and see if they can cut a deal that JBC would be the originator and then develop a network around that.
So essentially they have a right of first refusal.
I don't know if you'd call it a right of first refusal, but we asked them to go to JBC first. We've had a longstanding relationship.
Absolutely.
So absolutely, would you please talk to them and see if we can continue this relationship.
Illinois State Athletics Director Larry Lyons, thank you for joining us in the studio. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you very much.
Illinois State University's 10-year sales and marketing agreement with Learfield Sports begins immediately. The company currently has similar partnerships with more than 120 other universities, sports conferences, and arenas around the country, including the University of Illinois and most schools affiliated with the Missouri Valley Conference. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Your garden after winter, some plants are barely alive.
We can rebuild it. We have the technology. We have the know-how to make your garden grow. We can make it better than before. Better, greener, growier.
Bring new life to your garden with advice from Murph on Grow. Tomorrow at 8:50 and 4:50 on GLT. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A nonpartisan research group says Illinois' desperate financial condition is getting even worse. The Civic Federation of Chicago says unless something is done soon, by next year, the state's pile of unpaid bills could consume half of all new tax revenue. The group has published an 86-page report outlining where it thinks Illinois ought to go. IPR's Brian Mackey talked with Federation President Lawrence Massal about the group's analysis and recommendations.
Not having a budget is not the same thing as limiting the state's spending. The state has been spending more than it's been taking in for over 2 years now. And the budget that Governor Rauner has proposed relies on about $4.6 billion in a grand bargain concept that is in the Illinois General Assembly, in particular in the Senate. Unfortunately, there is not a level of certainty to rely on what that grand bargain will actually deliver. It's uncertain in terms of savings. It relies on one-time revenues. We're $4.6 billion short in terms of limiting the amount of known expenditures to known revenue, or at least is actually tied to that revenue. So we are unfortunately not able to support the governor's proposed budget. We're very concerned that even if the $4.6 billion in grand bargain funds is identified and enacted, the state would still see its backlog of unpaid bills grow to over $19.7 billion. That is unacceptable on so many levels, but the most expensive is the interest and penalties the state is going to pay for that level of unpaid bills and the damage that it's going to do to our vendors, social service providers, and people who provide the critical services to the state of Illinois. Having a $19.7 billion backlog in unpaid bills at the end of this year would mean that more than half of next year's revenue would have to be spent, 58.1% of it, just to pay off our unpaid bills from the previous year.
Well, can you talk about what you think is necessary, what the Civic Federation thinks is necessary to start digging us out of this?
First of all, the most important thing that the state of Illinois could do is enact a budget, any budget, that actually identifies the amount of known revenue and expected revenue that's reasonable and the amount of expenditures that the state is going to authorize for the coming year. Without a budget, we're not managing anything. Without a budget, we are racking up billions of dollars in liabilities that the state doesn't have money to pay for. So the Civic Federation starts out by saying we need to limit the rate of expenditure growth in the state of Illinois. By far, the best thing to do is get rid of the penalties on unpaid bills. Some of our bills we pay as much as 12% interest a year. Some we pay 9%. Some we don't even appropriate for and just ignore for the coming years. The Civic Federation follows the earlier recommendation of Governor Rauner to limit the rate of growth to 1.7%. That's less than the rate of inflation and would be basically a flattening of state expenditures. But it would allow, when combined with additional revenue, a balancing of the state budget.
And would that be based on the fiscal year 2015, the last time we actually had a full budget in Illinois?
It would be based on the current year. We would limit expenditure growth going forward to 1.7% going forward in 2018 for up to 5 years until we were able to balance this. But in order to do that, we would also have to increase revenue. And the Civic Federation recognizes that we need to bring the income tax rate back up to 5.25%. The temporary income tax increase rate was 5%. The Civic Federation is recommending that we raise it to 5.25%. There's nothing more expensive than ignoring your bills and ignoring your obligations. So if we raise the income tax on individuals up to 5.25%, we would be able to begin paying off our unpaid bills and balancing our budget so we could drop it back down to 5% in January of 2022. That revenue is not going to be enough unto itself, and the Civic Federation supports the elimination of the exemption on retirement income, the federally taxed retirement income. The federal government taxes your retirement income, but the surrounding states tax retirement income. Only Illinois has this most generous exemption that people who earn money, regardless of how much money they earn in retirement, are exempt from the Illinois income tax. We think you can exempt Social Security income and still generate over $2 billion to the state of Illinois, not because we want to raise taxes, but because we need to pay the $14 billion in unpaid bills and begin stabilizing our state government. We also support expanding the sales tax base to include services, as Governor Rauner and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel had both proposed earlier in their campaigns. If we raise the sales tax to include services, we could actually drop the sales tax rate from 5% to 4.25%. That would be a huge bonus to the citizens of Illinois, but also to the local governments that are at a disadvantage. The Civic Federation also believes consolidation is key to solving the state's problems going forward. We cannot operate so many units of government as inefficiently as we do. We need to begin consolidating pension funds. There's no reason to have a separate Chicago teachers pension fund separate from all the other state teachers pension funds around the state. We could save money on administration and definitely increase oversight and awareness and help the city of Chicago public schools avoid bankruptcy.
If a grand bargain or some sort of comprehensive deal remains elusive, in the past we've seen stopgaps, partial funding bills, funding schools but not other areas of government. Is that the way Illinois should go here?
The Civic Federation believes the temporary cherry-picking of some state programs that have political support or that are viewed as less politically attractive, ignoring them, is not the way to go. What we have done by funding elementary and secondary education but not funding higher ed, by paying all the state employees but not providing the mental health service providers, is we've created the illusion that the state is going forward in a reasonable fashion. We've taken the political pressure off the legislature and the governor to compromise in the middle, and it's costing us a fortune. This has been enormously damaging to the state's long-term financial health.
Lawrence Massal is the head of the Chicago Civic Federation. He spoke with IPR's Brian Mackey. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the most enduring characters in comic book history is Wonder Woman. A new book examines the psychology behind the superhero and how her complex nature makes her a standout in the DC universe. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
75 years ago, the character of Wonder Woman stormed into the DC universe. The demigoddess Amazonian princess displayed a moral complexity that revealed her as not simply a warrior, but a peace ambassador as well. The struggle between these identities is highlighted in a chapter in the new book, Wonder Woman Psychology, Lassoing the Truth. The chapter is written by Illinois State University psychology professors Eric Wesselman and Scott Jordan, along with ISU graduate student in the Department of Psychology, Emilio Lobato. Eric Wesselman says the three authors wanted to focus on a particular moral conundrum that Wonder Woman faced during a recent story arc.
She has to decide whether or not to basically kill this villain and save countless lives or not.
The villain that we're talking about is Maxwell Lord.
Correct.
That Wonder Woman killed off. But excuse me, but don't people get killed all the time in comic books?
Different superheroes have different moral codes about killing. So Batman and Superman, who form the basis of comparison for Wonder Woman in our chapter, they have very strict views against killing human beings. We wanted to make sure that we compared her to other characters in something along the moral dimensions.
Let's talk about the moral dimension within Wonder Woman's self-concept. First of all, what is self-concept? Emilio, can you define that for us?
Self-concept is just how you see yourself, the level of complexity with which you see yourself, the level of consistency across situations that you see yourself in. Wonder Woman is kind of a wonderful example of this because she is very honest about being a person of contradiction. And this is where we got the title of our chapter. She's balancing being a peace ambassador with a warrior for whom violence is not off the table. It's still an option when addressing conflict.
What is Wonder Woman's struggle? Does she struggle against killing versus just corralling evil?
She does decide to kill him, but mm-hmm. it's a very rational decision, mm-hmm. and she doesn't regret it. The biggest angst she has about it later is her arguments with Superman and Batman about mm-hmm. whether or not she should have done it.
First of all, you know, everyone has complicated aspects to their self. You know, we have personal characteristics, we have our social relationships, and we have culture that influences the way we view ourselves. And how we make moral decisions are oftentimes trying to balance these aspects. In the case of Wonder Woman, she is a peace ambassador, but she's also an Amazonian warrior, right? So she has trained all of her life in the arts of war, but yearns for peace. So it's this constant balance of when to use aggressive means in order to achieve a peaceful outcome that she struggles with.
The interesting thing is, though, Wonder Woman isn't human, but she seems, of the comic book characters of the three, what they call the DC Trinity, Batman, Superman, mm-hmm. and Wonder Woman, she seems the most human because of this.
She seems the most aware of her complexity. And I would also argue that her way of dealing with her dichotomy is not unlike the way military officers are trained. In the sense that military officers are trained to seek peace and value peace, but they're also trained to use violence and even organized violence in situations where certain lines have been crossed. My reading of her is she's very much a well-trained military person.
Do you think that perhaps Wonder Woman's moral complexity, the fact that she realizes sometimes it is necessary to go to war or to kill someone in order to achieve a larger goal of peace or preserving other lives. Do you think this sort of moral complexity is one of the reasons why this character has endured so long and has not gone gentle into that good night of comic book ever after?
I think that's certainly part of it. Distilling it down, characters like Superman and Batman represent a degree of wish fulfillment on the part of the reader. They are these kind of larger-than-life characters that can handle anything and always seem prepared for the situation. Wonder Woman, to a degree, represents that as well, but her creators never shied away from exploring that complexity of how to navigate life. She represents a point of view and a way of living that is atypical for the stereotypical comic book reader. And I know that Eric might have more to say on how Wonder Woman represents these different ways of being.
You know, one of the discussions classically about the history of Wonder Woman and her popularity, various different angles, but one is that she was one of the first female superheroes. A lot was discussed about that early in Wonder Woman's history, particularly early feminist thought. Wonder Woman became sort of an icon to rally behind, and I think the creators kind of intended mm-hmm. it that way, too. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why Marston wanted to create a female superhero was that there weren't any, really, at that time. There was no hero for, you know, young women who might be reading the comics to identify with, right? And then this issue of representation has become a large debate over the last several decades, mm-hmm. not just about gender, but about sexual orientation, about religion, about race, ethnicity, basically any sort of social category. It's important to be able to see ourselves and identify with these characters, mm-hmm. right? So having someone who looks like you, who is part of the same group, helps with that. I can speak from my two young daughters. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and both of them just really love Wonder Woman. My older daughter, when she was about 2.5, saw this DC cartoon, and she saw Wonder Woman in the intro, but Wonder Woman didn't actually show up in the episode. And she was very disappointed that Wonder Woman wasn't there. Just my younger daughter just the other day, she picked up this Wonder Woman tiara that we got and picked up this little golden thread and started swinging it around and said, "This is my lasso of truth." Mm-hmm. So clearly, I mean, this character resonates with them.
Can understanding Wonder Woman and the struggles that she has balancing the warrior and the peace ambassador, can that help us in our own personal reflection and come to terms with moral complexity?
I would almost say it's necessary to explore the self in a fictional environment. And whether it's a novel or a comic book or a TV show like Star Trek, it gives an audience member or a reader an avenue to explore these moral issues and personal issues in a safe way, to where they don't have to be committed to a particular point of view, but they can kind of play around with it in their head to see how much they identify or don't identify with the issue. Fiction affords us this playground, this safe space for us to explore ourselves, and then we go back into the real world and adjust ourselves accordingly.
Eric, what do you have to say to that?
I like to think of, and I'm not the only one, but I like to think of these sorts of issues as being like what philosophers use in terms of the trolley problem issue, where they put people in moral conundrums and kind of see how people reason through them. That's a classic paradigm in moral psychology. There really is no right or wrong answer. It's how you get to your ultimate answer. And because life is complex, that's uncomfortable. But to bridge to Emilio, this mm-hmm. is a safe space to navigate that discomfort.
And Scott, your feelings?
Well, we're all going to tell our stories about ourselves, stories about who we are anyway. We talk to other people. Should I do this? Should I not do this? What do you think? So we're generating fictions about ourselves already. Mm-hmm. And the fictions that work about us are fictions that are unconscious, that are in our unconscious assumptions about who people are, what they should want, what they should do. And the advantage of fiction is it provides us the opportunity to become conscious about what we're unconsciously assuming about ourselves and others all the time. So it's, and as Emilio said, it's a bit safer and it's a bit less tension producing for me to talk about Wonder Woman's traumas when they could very well be mine, mm-hmm. right? And then slowly but surely, when we can desensitize ourselves to contemplating our own moral conundrums, we have the opportunity to change. I'm not saying be better, be worse, but we have to make our unconscious assumptions about ourselves conscious before we can really actively change them. These provide a way to talk about that. What we want is for people to come to grips with their own complexity and then find a way to organize themselves in ways that they respect regarding their complexity, and then ask themselves to what extent the systems they've adopted to respect themselves are by default negating the values of others, right? And by having these continuous conscious conversations with yourself and others, we can see how much we may be causing pain, we may be causing others, because we think we're doing the right thing.
I love how we're examining this through comic books and comic book characters and superheroes.
So
this
do
is,
we.
This is, well, it's good for business, and it's good for work on the campus as well. It's interesting that we've come to this, that we realize that that pop culture has as much to offer us as the Iliad and the Odyssey mm-hmm. for right. discovering things about ourselves.
Yeah. We're getting such better writing these days. I just really think that when you look at the hero narratives or the human narratives that people have access to over 10 hours of a season, 30 hours in a three-year arc, the writers are having a better time. They're producing better work, and we're able to have complex stories that are discipline relevant, right? They're just not simple binaries that we as psychologists mm-hmm. can't really work with.
That's Emilio Lobato, Eric Wesselman, and Scott Jordan, authors of Balancing the Warrior and the Peace Ambassador, Self-Concepts and Moral Complexity, in the new book, Wonder Woman Psychology, Lassoing the Truth, edited by Travis Langley and Mara Wood. It's currently available at Amazon and other booksellers. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Wonder Woman comes to the big screen next month in a new film from Warner Brothers opening June 2nd. Hear a review of the movie from GLT's culture maven, Sherry Zeck, during an upcoming edition of Sound Ideas. You're listening to the theme from the 1970s TV version of Wonder Woman, starring Linda Carter. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find today's stories and interviews thanks to John Norton, Laura Kennedy, and Judy Valente at our website, WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find contact information. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas by tweeting. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. Wonder Woman.